that first talk I started around the 13th century. Well, I'm going to go back further. How's that?
Good.
All right? Okay. Mm-hmm. An artificial separation develops in spirituality once Christianity and Judaism divorce. The search for a separate identity is slow in style. First, followers of Jesus have no thoughts that their religion might be something other than Judaism. Their place of worship is the synagogue. Their way of life and mentality are shaped and informed by the Jewish religion. A difficulty does arise as more and more non-Jews become followers of Christ. It is assumed, because the Jewish Christians continue to see themselves as a group within Judaism, that these non-Jews will follow the dietary and purity codes of the Jewish religion and be circumcised. It is on this point that Paul intervenes. He strongly feels, some say demands, that the non-Jews should not be required to follow the codes of Judaism in order to be followers of Christ. This does not mean, however, as we have come to assume pretty much, that he understands Christianity as a distinct or separate religion. The Christian religion continues, in his mind, to be the Jewish religion. Animosity develops and escalates, in particular after the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem. But even before that, we have skirmishes. So, for example, we hear of the skirmishes between some of the temple god and the Hellenist Jews who are following Christ. But it's after the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem that things begin to really heat up. The Pharisees, another grouping in Judaism, who really don't have a great deal of power or say, while the temple and the city of Jerusalem exist, that's where the Sadducees and the Herodians have greater power, take on a greater role and promote a way of life that will help prevent the Jewish religion from disappearing. The Jews have gone into what is called the diaspora. Their temple and city, which is the focus of their religion, is no more. And so they have to find another focus. What will unite them? How is God present to them? Is the question. Temple worship, which is no longer possible, is replaced with synagogue worship. Synagogues were present before the temple, but had lesser importance. And the living of the purity ritual codes, the commandments, the 608 commandments of Moses, for example, take on a greater importance. One of the side effects that Jewish Christians, one of the side effects of this re-emphasis, focusing on the synagogues, promoting the commands of Moses, is that Jewish Christians are less and less tolerant and essentially are thrown out of the synagogues. The Pharisees, the rabbis, if you will, come up with a decree that all are to recite as they enter the synagogue. Well, since the decree, the creed, was essentially anti-Christian, obviously the Christians could not give credence to that. It's also because most of the followers of Christ now are non-Jews and are not following or fulfilling the purity ritual codes, nor are most of them circumcised. This situation is also exacerbated by Jewish Christian theologians becoming more and more influenced by Greek philosophy. Now, in saying that, I am not saying that Greek philosophy is a bad thing. It's simply just another way of looking at life. Okay? One of the ways in which the theologians promoted the separation on their side is by claiming that Jesus founds a church, which is a clear distinction from worshiping in the temple or synagogue. The Greek word ekklesia is very distinct from synagoge. They do this and underemphasize that Jesus worships in both the temple and the synagogue, so much so that it's completely forgotten that Jesus is a Jew. Jewish theology, at its best, speaks of a dynamic unity. It's part of the Eastern way of seeing, in which the relationship that God has with us is necessarily connected to the relationship that we have with each other. So God's relationship with us equates into our relationship with each other. Got it? Right. If you have any questions, feel free. The body in Jewish theology, Jewish way of seeing the world, is not separated from the soul. The two are united. The two are one. Greek philosophy essentially speaks of dualism. Plato, who significantly influences the now completely separated Christian theologians of the 4th century, promotes a dualistic world in which the body is distinct and separate from the spirit. Further, the body incarcerates the spirit and prevents the spirit from living freely. It is only when the body dies it comes to be thought, is the spirit free? Got that so far?
Mm-hmm.
Right. The divorce from Judaism also causes a separation in Christian thought regarding God's relationship with us and our relationship with each other. As Greek dualism takes hold, so does the thinking that God's relationship with us is individualized. No longer do we say we, now we say I. And the sense of community is essentially lost. Individual devotions, for example, quickly multiply. Whereas the biblical Jews readily accept that all creation is blessed because it is God who creates. So God is to be praised. Christians now feel the need to ask God to bless a person or a thing, or they remain profane. That's why we call this the sanctuary, as opposed to the profane. One consequence of this change is the emphasis that Christianity places on removing or separating ourselves from the profane world. Monasticism, after the martyrdom ends, monasticism develops. What's the purpose of monasticism? It's called the white martyrdom. If we can't get killed, we're going to kill ourselves. I'm just being facetious there.
Mm.
Since we can only be with God, so the thinking develops, once our bodies die, ways need to be found in order to eliminate the body as much as possible. Hermits, ascetics, celibates, virgins, priests, monks, nuns, and numerous other ways to promote holiness, that is, being separate, the way of perfection, as a result, developed. So that profanity, also called imperfection, can be overcome, mastered, and eliminated. Marriage, don't take my word for it, go look it up. Marriage becomes a necessary evil whose sole purpose is to propagate the earth. Sex is a somewhat tolerated moral failure, concupiscence, as long as procreation is its only purpose. This is not to say that such separations are completely absent from Judaism. They too emphasize separation, the pure versus the impure, for example. And the Essenes, and later the Hasidim, separate themselves from the world. We learn from Judaism. Christianity, however, takes it to a new level. Please note that I am not being critical of the path that Christianity takes once it separates from Judaism. I hope, by highlighting the changes, to help us see what prevents us from experiencing union with God and each other in creation. To point out the influences that are so much part of our lives that we don't know that they're there. One of the pitfalls of separation is that many of us become good, very good, at deflecting. We can, in a moment of weakness, experience, for example, regret for an unkind word, an unkind action, a selfish decision. Or someone might seek to help us see the hurt that we have caused. In a twinkling of an eye, we deflect the experience, often onto someone else. Both Mussolini and Hitler, for example, were masters at deflecting. There's a few politicians nowadays that are very good at it too. Mm-hmm. The side effect of deflecting is evil. The absence of God. That is, we operate as though God's relationship with us is separate and independent from our relationship with each other in creation. It's me and God. Community is replaced by ritual, efficiency, and privacy. This usually leads to our sincere belief that we are doing God's will as we do evil. A silly example, but a real example. People who become enraged by other people interacting before or after Eucharist. Which is meant to be a communal event. The scriptures invite us to see that there is another reality. A dynamic unity. Dynamic unity doesn't negate the need that we have for limitations and boundaries. It doesn't eliminate morality. Rather, dynamic unity leads us to live a moral way of life. The difference is, our moral way of life isn't an achievement or an end in itself. It is a natural sense of union with each other and creation in which we are free to experience peace with each other. Dynamic union frees us to stop deflecting and to observe the numerous ways in which we continue to be afraid and as a result, attempt to resist and control our lives and the lives of others. Sarah Teasdale offers us a glimpse of the ongoing struggle that we face, knowingly or unknowingly. She writes, "I am not yours, not lost in you, not lost, although I long to be, lost as the candle lit at noon, lost as a snowflake in the sea. You love me, and I find you still, a spirit beautiful and bright. Yet I am I, who long to be lost as a light is lost in the light. Oh, plunge me deep in love. Put out my senses. Leave me deaf and blind. Swept by the tempest of your love, a taper in a rushing wind." Spirituality, once Christianity and Judaism divorce, and Christianity accepts the duality of Greek philosophy, becomes in many ways schizophrenic. The divine becomes divorced in our minds from the human, and we become very afraid. Fear drives us, impels us to keep others at a distance, that community isn't possible. Only those who are mystics, that is, those who experience the dynamic unity of the divine with the human, are sometimes free of fear. The poetry of John of the Cross, much like the lyrics of Sarah Teasdale, reveals that he is a mystic. It's not something that he achieves. It happens. The explanatory prose, much of which is written at the urging of Sister Anna, I believe, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Oh, good. So you people know more about this than I do. Reveals the dependency that we have on duality. This is not meant as a belittlement to John. Rather, its intent is to help us see the unseen influences that directly or indirectly affect our lives. I will offer one example. We tend to assign, most often, I suspect, a purpose or a goal to prayer. We pray, most often, I suspect, purposefully for people, places, things, or hopes and dreams. Silly aside, I recall having a serious conversation with a couple who buried the statue of St. Joseph upside down in their yard in order to sell their house. We pray purposefully, seeking direction. Some to whom I bring communion on a monthly basis have a pile of prayers, quite literally, sometimes they're about that much, that they diligently say each day. One carries a statue of St. Jude with her, and the statue is placed beneath her pillow when she sleeps. That would give me a headache. Please, do not think that I am making fun or belittling any of these people. Nor am I saying that any of this is wrong. They are doing what they have been taught to do. And I have no doubt that God is with them, because that is who God is for us. The unfortunate side effect of always praying purposefully is that we are prevented from experiencing union. We dwell instead, essentially, in duality, the realm of purpose and intent. When John gives expression to the unitive experience that happens to him, his expression, now I'm moving into the difficult part here, I tried to type it out ahead of time, but I didn't have time to do that, is one of counterintuitive. One of contradiction and paradox in his word images. In other words, he's writing poetry. They have no purpose. If you read the poetry of John, and maybe this is why so many people struggle with the poetry, it has no purpose. They do not explain. Rather, they escape from him. The words, the images escape from him. When he gives purpose to these expressions, these images, he is required to use purposeful and dualistic language. There is nothing wrong with his efforts. He is fulfilling a request made of him. And I suspect he was processing what was going on. This explanation can be helpful, and it can hinder us. Not because they are wrong, incorrect, or inaccurate. Rather, the hindrance comes from our always living purposefully. This isn't going to work, so I'm going to have to wing it from here. So when I was saying previously that the sense that I had with regards to John and his poetry is that the living flame of love happens. The sense of union, the sense of that dynamic unity in which John finds himself and loses himself only to be found again. Leads him to the dark night. I made reference the last time to my nephew and his family and I going into this dark cave where all the lights were put out and out of the eyes of all present when it was perfectly dark, went searching for light. Well, that's what happens. Because we live in both the dualistic world and the unitive world, there is a part of us that is always searching for light, for understanding, for explanations. It's like our eyes in pitch darkness. They're constantly searching. What is that? Is that not the darkness of which John speaks? That happens after we have experienced union, that dynamic unity. It can feel quite terrifying. And our tendency is to want to find the answers, to come to some kind of explanation of what's going on. And so we tend to revert back to that dualistic way of thinking. We're not meant to do away with dualistic way of thinking. We can't. It can help us, however. It can help us when it fails. When we don't have an explanation. When we find ourselves in darkness. I mentioned in the past that God is beyond us. God cannot be explained by us. God is a question rather than an answer. As such, the only way in which we can dwell in that uncertainty is by knowing union with God and with each other. God is community. If we are continually practicing living outside of community in our individual devotions, if we are continually practicing prayer that is purposeful rather than purposeless, we are not making ourselves, helping ourselves become available to who God creates us to be. Too bad I had a wonderful ending, but I don't know what it is. We cannot make dynamic unity happen. It already exists. We can practice dynamic unity by also practicing, at least for part of the time in which we pray. If we pray without purpose. Now that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But certainly, it does not mean that we can pray purposely and think it's not purposeful. I'm losing clarity here, I know. We can approach our time of prayer and sometimes we can even see that divide. Time in which we practice prayer without purpose. And prayer in which we are purposeful. Some of the ways in which we are purposeful in prayer, for example, the office, praying for people or things, reading, be that reading about things or even reading a daily reflection. Prayer that is purposeless has no purpose that we can assign to. I hesitate sharing with you my purposeless prayer. Because we all have to find ways to be purposeless in our prayer. So I'm not going to share. Normally I have a much better ending than this, but I'm out of words. So if you have any questions, feel free.
Yes.
You